Father John A. Hardin, S.J., is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is one of a series of lectures given by Father John Hardin in Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book, Religions of the World. Father Hardin first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, the Hindu sacraments. Father Hardin.
What I want to take up now is the matter of the equivalence of the Hindu sacraments. Now, they may be called purifications, but the word is not correct, because purification, for us at least, connotes some kind of, well, something wrong done, and almost smacks of legalism. Whereas these samskaras, I don't have the word on the board, or the plural with an S at the end, S-A-M-S-K-A-R-A, are, and there's no equivalent in English, but they correspond to some ritual which must be performed. So first of all, it's a ritual. Secondly, it's one which is mandatory. Thirdly, it is to be performed at stated times. And fourthly, the blessings of the gods, or at least of Brahman, are assured for the person at those stated times, only if the ritual has been faithfully done. The word samskara is simply adopted by Christian missionaries as sacrament. So the Sanskrit for sacrament is samskara. Whereas, you know, the early, well, Christians, when they looked around for words to describe what we now call the sacraments, they came upon the two words, musterion, which corresponds roughly to our English mystery in the Greek, and sacramentum, the musterion taken from the Greek religions, and the sacramentum, which was part of Roman religion, where the Roman soldiers were to vow a sacramentum, vow themselves to military service, and as a consequence, of course, were promised even divine protection. At any rate, the Hindu is samskara. There is no agreement on the exact number of the samskaras. Some would count up to 40. But there are few who hold that large number, because they include certain household ceremonies that are repeated, whereas these, technically speaking, the big four, the principal four, are not repeated. Some because they can't be, some because they shouldn't be. The four principal samskaras are those performed at birth, at the beginning of adolescence, at marriage, and at death. Something about each. Let me preface this before we start this. In fact, looking back now, and it's 15 years that I have been studying the Oriental religions. And as I look back, and I've been teaching when I can, when somebody invites me to teach Oriental religions, I do so. And I do some writing as much as I have time for. But most of my teaching naturally is in Catholic theology. But I honestly mean this when I say that I wonder how effectively at least a professional Catholic theologian, can teach theology unless he knows a lot about other religious systems. I couldn't begin to describe, it's indescribable, the insight and the meaning put into my own Christian faith by my knowledge, such as it is, of the faith of other peoples. And among the things is the concern, now the first one, the great concern which every Hindu has, which every believer in the universe has, for somehow propitiating the God at birth. This language I used when we conducted a joint program with one of the Protestant Divinity Schools for 2 years now. They don't have baptism, infant baptism. They belong, as you know, the Baptists in general don't baptize in infancy. And these are in the Free Church tradition, which is even, you might say, less concerned about infant baptism. They have baptism in either adulthood or at least in young adolescents. And one of the great satisfactions I've had, it happens to be the Church of the Brethren, a membership in the States about 500,000, but a very closely knit group, highly respected. They run some good schools and have had a great deal of influence on American culture. They're over 2 centuries old. But among the things which have happened in the 2 years that we have worked together, that is their faculty and two of us, is that while they have not yet introduced infant baptism, they have since introduced infant initiation rites in which the child is offered to God, prayers are invoked, and the person is somehow believed to become a member of the church, which this particular denomination did not have. And the man who drafted the ritual happens to be Dean of the seminary with whom we cooperated, and he is the one, in fact, who drafted the ritual for the whole denomination. And in talking about this, I told him that his name is Dr. Groff, and of course we're on a John and Warren basis. And I said, Warren, of course by that time he was quite convinced on other grounds, but I said, Warren, there's no religion known to man, known to history, that does not offer its children to the God in whom it believes. Well, this ceremony, therefore, the birth ceremony, and by the way, it gives also a great deal of satisfaction because when, you know, we have this big problem of salvation outside the church, and if baptism is essential for salvation, what about these millions, multi-millions, who are never baptized, just on that level? Well, I have no trouble, because for me, the God that I believe in is one who is merciful enough to accept this ritual as the equivalent of baptism. And I believe that theory is valid enough because it happens to be the theory in the New Catholic Encyclopedia. I happen to write the article on salvation outside the church. But you must know and realize that this ritual is something which is common to all religious cultures. It is done by the husband, or in this case, of course, the father. And let me add, illegitimate marriages are almost unknown in the sense of unwed mothers, almost unknown to Hinduism. So when we see performed by the father, we also mean by the husband. As soon as the baby is born, the father, I'll just briefly describe the ritual without going into too much detail. The father rubs its tongue with a mixture of rice and barley and gives that child some ghee mixed with gold powder to eat. At the end of their rites, which has a special name, the father of the baby says, now here's the ritual which he, the word that he pronounces, cut the navel cord and give the breast. In other words, symbolically saying, this is the end of relationship with the mother, this is the beginning of dependence on others. Now there's dependence on, but notice, the thing is addressed to the mother. When the child is 4 months old, it is taken out for the first time in the open air. So the child is kept indoors for 4 months. The father stands outside in the evening, facing the moon. The mother puts the baby in his hands, and the baby is offered to the moon. Now again, as much as I read to the contrary, I don't think the average Hindu is an idolater. So when we say to the moon, somehow behind that moon is a reality whom the parents worship. The next ceremony is the giving of the name, which can also be done on the birthday of the child. So it may be done on the first birthday of the child. Standing on the right of her husband, the mother puts the baby in the hands of the father. There's a variety of invocations uttered according to the day and the planet of the birth of the child. Then the father writes two different names on two stones and lights a small oil lamp before each. You know, there are things that could be done. I don't want to get lost. There are too many ideas that come to my mind while I'm supposed to be teaching Hinduism. But I think there's much more ritual that could go into the time of birth, preparatory to baptism, and during the early months of the child. And by the way, when Hindus are received into the church, when they become Christians, much of this remains. I'm sure that many Christians don't go to as much trouble as this to pick a name for their child. I baptized a few babies. The father writes two different names on two stones and lights a small oil lamp before each. That name must be chosen. Notice, somehow God is behind this. That name must be chosen before which the lamp gives the bigger flame. Touching the mouth, the nose, the eyes, and the ears of the baby, the father pronounces two invocations, whispers the name of the child in the mother's left ear and the child's right ear, and puts the child in the lap of the mother. Then, and this in general, we prefix a name depending on the caste to which the child belongs. And if you want to jot down the prefixes, you can, I think, from now on be able to spot the caste to which a Hindu belongs. A Brahmin's name should have the suffix sarma, which means auspicious. A Vaishya's name, a Kshatriya's name, the suffix varma, which means armor. So sarma for the Brahmin, varma for the Kshatriya. And a Vaishya's name, the suffix gupta or data, D-double-T-A. For example, one of the greatest Hindu philosophers is Das Gupta. Das being the family name and Gupta being the caste name, or Datta, D-double-T-A. And a Shudra's name should have the suffix Dasa, D-A-C-A, which means, and what else would it mean except servant. Talk about making sure that he doesn't step out of his caste. Girls' names should be auspicious, easy to pronounce, and without harsh letters, of clear meaning and pleasant to the ear, denote good fortune, and end with long vowels, which express a blessing, because vocalic sounds in Sanskrit are benediction. We have so far seen regarding the samskaras something about the ritual performed at the birth of a child. As I mentioned, and I would like to both repeat and emphasize, here Hinduism is typical of all religious systems where there is a faith in the degree to which a people pull away from faith in the sense of the acceptance of a world and a reality beyond the empirical. They get away from what we would call the sacraments. But insofar as the faith of a people is viable, and among most Hindus it is very strong, they do have a birth ritual. Behind it, of course, is the implication that surely at the beginning of human life, one needs to invoke the god or gods in whom one believes. It is therefore the first sign of that sense of contingency which I define as religion. This is my generic definition of religion, no matter where found, the sense of contingency. We briefly refer to the ceremonial just to very shortly recap. The birth ceremonial consists of three rites, R-I-T-E-S, of course. One immediately after birth, at the moment a child is born, and even before it has separated itself from the mother, where the father is right there and he pronounces the word invoking the Vedic deities, cut the navel cord and give the breast. The second is performed 4 months later, when, as we said, the child for the first time is taken out of doors. It is offered to the moon, though, as I want to emphasize, whenever there are signs of what look like nature worship in Hinduism, I don't doubt that many Hindus are still native worshippers or nature worshippers. I do believe they are not, in our technical sense, idolaters. The offering to the moon is rather a symbolic gesture, somehow offering to the god or gods standing behind the forces of nature. And then the third ceremonial, performed often on the first birthday of the child, on its first anniversary, when the child is named, and we describe somewhat the ritual of that naming. The second ritual is that of initiation. Did we go into this yet, sisters? I don't think we did. Its technical name is Upanayana. Upanayana. If you want the Sanskrit name for the first, the equivalent of the Christian baptism, it is Garbhadana. G-A-R-B-H-A-D-H-A-N-A. Garbhadana. The Upanayana, the initiation ceremonial, otherwise than the birth ceremonial, is only for the boys. All children of both sexes are initiated, pardon me, are, quotes, baptized Hindu-wise, but only the boys are given the initiation ceremony. And the reason, no doubt, is because it is the boy, and later on the man, who is to carry on the responsibilities of his caste. Because the initiation technically is into the caste, corresponding approximately to being initiated into the church among Christians. As might be expected with the growing culturalization of India, its urbanization, which often means westernization, while the first rite is rather faithfully kept, the second is more difficult to keep, not because the ceremonial couldn't be gone through, but because its obligations are so hard to keep up. even as they among the Jews, with their bar mitzvah ceremony, which, of course, you recall in the Gospel of Luke, where Jesus is introduced into his bar mitzvah at the age of 12. Well, where the Jews are still able, among the Orthodox, to very faithfully keep the ceremonial, the dietary laws, and so on, the bar mitzvah is faithfully kept, though again it becomes less and less important as the observances are more difficult to keep. So too among the Hindus. However, some type of initiation rite is still observed. We will here describe the ideal where the most faithful Hindu is involved. Three different ages are concerned, depending on the caste to which the boy belongs, or better, into which he is born. He technically belongs or begins to belong after the initiation rite. For the Brahmins, it's at the age of 8. Very briefly, to point up the ritual and then perhaps draw out some of the more significant implications. The boy's head is shaven except for the very top of the crown of his head. The initiation ceremony is always performed by a Brahmin, who of course belongs to the priestly caste. At the beginning of the ceremonial, the Brahmin and the boy let water fall from their hands. In other words, they have a vessel and they spill water. Throughout this ceremony, the stress is on making the boy conscious of the obligations that he is assuming as a member of the caste. The Brahmin touches at various points of the ceremonial various parts of the boy's body, his shoulders and his navel. By the way, the navel figures very much, as you will have noticed, in various rites of the Hindu religion, to a certain extent also in the Buddhist religion. The reason, as you can guess, is obvious. It is the symbol of life. And the relationship, by the way, between him and the source of his life, namely his mother. The constant reminder, therefore, of his dependence for his life on someone who gave him life. His heart is touched, and various parts of his head, his eyes, ears, and mouth. He is at this time given the name Brahmacharyan, which you will recall is the initiation into the first of the four stages of the believing Hindu's life, where the word itself technically means celibate, and where the celibacy refers not only to abstention from carnal intercourse until the boy marries, but symbolizes also the sacrifice, the postponement of those legitimate pleasures, also, for example, of the palate, until the boy marries and begins in his own household. It is at this time also that he is invested with the holy thread that he will later on, as we recall in the morning ritual, he will place on himself before and while he prays. There are three strands of the thread, symbolic of the three major Vedic deities, and the thread is different both in texture and in color for the respective castes. The Brahmins have cotton, the Kshatriyas use hemp, the Vaishyas use wool. It is also for the first time that the boy officially, though he may well have learnt this before, and the home training of the believing Hindu boy is very good. In other words, The parents don't wait until he is 8 or 12 years old for the first time to introduce him to some of the fundamentals of human conduct, including prayer. But he has never until this time pronounced the famous Gayatri, which must be the fifth or sixth time we refer to it, that prayer which, quite literally, a boy and eventually a man ought to have pronounced no less than 2 million times in his lifetime, though there are ways of obviating that obligation by having others, including groups, do it for him. It's also at this point that the prayer, while it may have been learned, to recall the passage we quoted, and the famous, that's, by the way, this is one prayer that you can expect to get in the final examination, the least I can expect you to memorize of Hindu ritual. It is, however, not only pronounced as a prayer, it is also now, for the first time, and when so used ritually, includes the famous monosyllable OM, which is the sacred name of Brahman. Actually, it's almost just, you might say, an aspirate. It's just, in itself, a syllable that does not have intrinsic meaning, yet it is never used except to symbolize Brahman. It is the most famous, single most sacred word in the Hindu language. And consequently, the boy for the first time repeats after the Brahmin, Om, O-M. On that desirable splendor of the sun, then a pause, Om, let us meditate on the radiance of that God. May he stimulate our thoughts. And you recall the version I'm giving you now is a little different from the one I gave you before. Substantially, it is the same. This is the one that, again, I got from one of our Jesuits in India, who took it from the ritual at the time when the boy becomes a Brahmacharin. However, the very insertion of the sacred name, to me at least, would prove conclusively that while it is the son to whom the words I directed in the famous Gayatri, it is nevertheless Brahman beyond the son, though very vaguely conceived, who is actually invoked. I have in my notes that Om is the mystic name of the Absolute. It is the name that, I am told, the pious Hindu boy in a Jesuit school will put on top of his essay. Om, therefore, corresponds to the sacred name Jesus, or God, or for the Muslim, Allah. From then on, from the moment that he is invested into the caste of the family to which he belongs and becomes a Brahmacharin, he assumes all the duties of his caste, notably the one duty of frequently during the day. And this, by the way, and I like to point this out because I thought to myself, how much of Hindu spirituality will I talk about? Well, I said to myself, 10 classes or 10 days is a very short time. We don't have it. And there's too much substantive matter in Hinduism and also in Buddhism that I think needs to be gone through in as short an institute as we have during these 2 weeks. I would like to point out one feature of Hindu spirituality, and is something that we can learn from: the insistence from childhood on of a constant repetition of vocal prayer, during which recitation the person is bidden to unite himself in spirit with a God whom he invokes. And the Gayatri is the one that is most frequently used. And while we may smile and perhaps consider it a bit of fetishism to think of a repetition of something 2 million times, I think there is profound instinctive wisdom both in the importance of having a set ritual in its constant repetition, but above all, and this is of course the guarantee, in periodic meditation, so that when the symbolic words are used, a person puts into that symbolic expression all the meaning and feeling which he has gained through meditation between repetitive vocal prayer. The third samskara which pious Hindus observe, and one I am told which they don't fail to observe because most of them marry, is the vivaha, V-I-V-A-H-A, which is corresponding to our matrimony. Even when the other rituals, that is the previous two, though they may be somehow entered into but not so faithfully kept, this one at least is faithfully observed. There are three stages to this ritual, and all three belong to the samskara, or the sacraments. The first might be called, and very roughly, correspond to the substitute for courtship, since they don't have courtship. There's no courting among believing Hindus. The courting is done for them by their parents. And the second is the giving away, and quite literally, the parents give away their respective sons and daughters, and then the exchange of consent at long last. Almost a kind of an afterthought. Maybe they would like to have something to say. The parents are the ones, first of all, therefore, who choose the bride and groom, and it's not just the bride whose father or parents, as the case might be, or if the parents should be dead, either one, then someone who is guardian for the girl. It's also the groom. Though in modern India, men have a little more to say, yet they too, among most of India's millions, most of the young people have their choice made for them. And family life, I am assured by those who study this, is most stable in India. Which is not to say that we are promptly to imitate, and we won't. There's no danger. The parents are the ones who choose the bride and groom. At the same time, they don't trust their own judgments. They consult. They inquire. There are long periodic dialogues beforehand. And above all, and this is something which I think deserves emphasis, or they consult horoscopes too, but if they can afford it, they hire the help of a man called a Ghataka, G-H-A-T-A-K-A, Ghataka, who is an expert in genealogies. In other words, it is believed, and the genealogy here is not something esoteric, it's plain genealogy. What and what kind of skeletons are there or were there in the family closet? Now, this is certainly tied in with their religion.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.